Sports talk is loaded with hyperbole. This is not hyperbole. Yesterday was the biggest day in the history of the Phoenix Coyotes. The often abysmal NHL team defeated the Nashville Predators last night and advanced to the conference finals for the first time ever. And 3 years after the team's last owner declared bankruptcy, the league announced that it likely has found a new owner, one that will keep the team in the area. For more on the Coyotes' reversal of fortune, we're joined by Paula Bovin. She is a sports columnist for the Arizona Republic. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So let's get down to it. What is going on with this team? Why are they suddenly looking good on the ice?
Well, a couple of things have happened, but I think the biggest thing is that they hired a general manager in Don Maloney several years ago who really knows the NHL. You know, with the NHL ownership, there were real restrictions about how much this organization could spend. But I think Don Maloney put guys who really connected in the locker room, a real good mix of veterans and young players. And if you walk in that locker room, it's pretty amazing, the relationships. And I know that sounds so corny sometimes, but it has made such a difference with this team. There are no superstars. But because there are no superstars, every player truly believes he has to step up and he has a role, and it has served them well this season on the ice.
So obviously fans in Phoenix must be really excited, but are they also, you know, surprised or stunned?
Yeah, you know, it's been such an interesting thing here because the entire stay and tenure of this team in Phoenix, there's been a cloud of disappointment, fear, what's going to happen to this team. There's always been a threat of moving. So it's really been difficult for this community to connect with this team, because they didn't want to be jilted. So fans have been excited, but you can see it growing now. Now that there's a real belief that this team is going to stick around, now that this team is playing great, and this is probably the most likable and approachable group of athletes I've been around in my very long career, and the community is picking up on that.
So 3 years this team's been controlled by the NHL. I mean, why has it taken so long for the league to find a potential owner?
Because, you know, the reality is many sports franchises lose money. You have to have someone to buy a professional team that's not in it to make a profit. So I think they really had to find someone who had a love of hockey. And, you know, certainly in the United States, that's not something you'll necessarily find. So it certainly just took them some time to find the right people. But they really feel confident, I think, with Greg Jamieson, the potential owner, that this is going to get done probably within the next few weeks.
Now, I don't want to rain on the parade for Phoenix, but even though they're having a good moment, the team has been near the bottom in attendance for a decade. I mean, is there any sense of whether a team can actually thrive there in the long term?
Yeah, you know, it's a fair question because they have really struggled with fans even when they were winning. I think there's two things that we'll see happening. I think one, as I mentioned before, with the knowledge that this team is going to stick around once the new owner comes, people will be more committed. But the other thing is, because they've never had much money, and part of the time they've been owned by the NHL, they've never been able to do a really great job of marketing. And the reality here in the Phoenix area is that there are a lot of people from Canada who come here in the winter. There's a lot of people from Canada who move here permanently. And the Canadians, bless their hearts, love hockey and will be willing to buy a lot of tickets. And I think they're really going to try to tap into that fan base through marketing, which they just really haven't been able to do very well in the past.
Paula, thank you for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Paula Bovin is a sports columnist for the Arizona Republic.
This is NPR News.
2 years ago, commentator Kelly Hampton thought she had it all. A healthy family, a wonderful toddler, and another child on the way.
See that right there? The obstetrician asked as she glided the sonogram wand across my middle and pointed to a blurry image on the monitor. It's a girl, she announced. A girl. That meant a sister for my daughter, Lainey, which, according to my life plan, put me somewhere right near exactly how it's supposed to go. Sisters. I anticipated their friendship the last months of my pregnancy just as much as I looked forward to my first inhalations of newborn skin. After all, I have a sister. I know the value that kinship adds to my life, and I was certain that along with a real-life baby doll to feed and dress up, I was giving my older daughter a greater gift, a best friend. So when the doctor told me an hour after our little sister slipped into the world that Nella had Down syndrome, there were two waves of grief that followed. One for myself and all that I had hoped for, and one, perhaps even deeper, for the bond of sisterhood I had excitedly awaited for my girls, the one that I mistakenly thought faded into the blur of things we'll never know. I unraveled hopes those first few nights, pulled out all the things I loved about having a sister, and grieved the loss of each one for my girls. Things like calling 4 times a day, trading recipes for stuffed green pepper soup, laughing about when we know we're right and Mom's wrong, asking advice for teething remedies in 2-year-old fits. And what would their childhood look like? Would they fight over clothes and build secret forts in their closets? While I cannot be certain what the future holds based on the span of 2 years, I can say that my 4-year-old daughter and her 2-year-old little sister have exactly what I had hoped for, unique companionship, and all the things my sister and I shared so many years ago. I have found my girls hidden under secret closet forts and have negotiated many crying fits over dolls and crayons and the last M&M. Looking back, I realize it was my sister who offered me my first bit of hope when she showed up to the hospital the day after Nella was born. The first to welcome her without any grief or apology, she held Nella close. "She's beautiful," she exclaimed. Sensing my own doubts for what my girls would share, my sister continued, "Kelly, there's always a plus side. Lainey might not call Nella for a chicken casserole recipe, but she'll be changed in ways she wouldn't be otherwise. You see, the best part about sisters is that they are mirrors in which we see ourselves, offering us more hope and compassion than we are sometimes able to give. Bonded by genetics and united by a shared past, my girls will have everything they need, each other."
That's Kelly Hampton. Her memoir, Bloom, Finding Beauty in the Unexpected, is out now.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block. The Senate took up competing proposals today to keep the interest rate for federal student loans from doubling. Neither Democrats nor Republicans want to be blamed for a rate jump in a few weeks, but lawmakers can't agree on how to pay for keeping the rate low. As NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports, the political stalemate has mobilized students who are on Capitol Hill pleading with lawmakers to stop the bickering.
Clarice McCants and Patrick Johnson, both undergraduates at Howard University, are running late. They're joining students from California and Ohio who've come to Capitol Hill to deliver a message to Congress. Don't let the interest rate on federal Stafford loans double. It would be devastating, says Patrick.
Because there's a chance that after leaving college that I may not have a job immediately after, and I'm still going to have to pay back these loans eventually. It would really set me back in debt even further.
$1,000 means a lot to me, you know what I mean?
That's how much more would be added, on average, to every new Stafford loan for every year a student is in college, if the interest rate jumps from 3.4% to 6.8% on July 1st. Clarice says, for her, it's a lot.
The student loan rate increase will effectively make college even less affordable for me next year. And, you know, these additional costs may seem minimal compared to, you know, the fiscal budget or, frankly, the salary of a congressman. But they're a big burden to people like me who are, you know, economically disadvantaged. So
Clarice, Patrick, and the other students organized with the help of the liberal Center for American Progress. Their first visit is with Senator Rob Portman, Republican from Ohio. Portman is all for the idea of keeping rates down, but doesn't want to pay for it by doing what Democrats propose, which is to close a payroll tax loophole used by business owners. Republicans want to pay for it by eliminating a preventive health care fund.
Thank you. Appreciate it. You have a good day.
You too.
Thank you.
After meeting with Portman staff, Tiffany Lofton, a student at the University of California at Santa Cruz, sounds upset about something one of the senator's staff members said.
I have $38,000 in debt, like I told her, and it doesn't seem like she understood how urgent that was because she said it wasn't an urgent matter. I was disappointed, though.
Another group of people who also seem disappointed are policy wonks who've been watching this political skirmish unfold, especially after President Obama began pummeling Republicans with the issue.
This small policy issue that the president's made a big deal out of has in many ways been overblown.
Matthew Chingos is with the Brookings Institution.
I think interest rates are certainly important, but the policy he's talking about is really about an interest rate on one type of federal loan and only on new loans that'll be issued in July and going forward.
For Republicans and Democrats, says Chingos, it's just one more issue with which to attack each other. But more importantly, it's a lost opportunity.
So I think the president got the whole country talking about higher education, focused on this one piece when there's this much broader set of issues about affordability.
Chingo says a serious conversation about college access, costs, and reforming the federal student loan program has given way to political bickering that does little to help students. Congress has less than 8 weeks to come up with a relief plan. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
We turn now from consumer protection to personal finance. It's been weeks since that huge lottery jackpot made just a few people millionaires and left many of the rest of us with worthless tickets stuffed in our junk drawers. But if the disappointment of not being a few $100 million richer is still on your mind, this conversation is for you. If you're still contemplating the fantasy of what you could do with money like that, college and retirement funds paid up, a second home, shopping sprees, a life with no worries, our next guest says that old cliche really is true. Mo money, mo problems. And he says he should know because he is a financial and legal advisor to the very wealthy. He has a new book out. It's called Fables of Fortune, What Rich People Have That You Don't Want. His name is Richard Watts, and he is with us now. Mr. Watts, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Michelle. Thank you for asking me.
Now, you know, Mr. Watts, let me just say that the first thing I bet is on a lot of people's minds is not the troubles of the wealthy. It's the trouble of getting by, you know, trying to make sure that their kids are educated, that the mortgage is, you know, paid every month. So, you know, given the economic troubles that we've been having in this country and also around the world. So what's your thought about why this is the right time for this book?
Well, I really don't think that the book was meant to expose or to be an expose of wealthy people, but really to talk to the middle class and to say to the middle class, you spend an awful lot of your time dreaming about things you probably will not have. And I can tell you that once you get to what you call the promised land, it may not be as good as you think.
You do not pull any punches in this book, you know, I have to say. And one of the things that you are very blunt about is how wealth can unravel and compromise marriages. For example, you write, when you wake up at night and see your spouse sleeping next to you, what do you see? Has she stood by you for a long time? Has he done his best to provide you with a worthwhile life? Has he or she made you feel like you deserve to be alive and loved? You talk about the fact that oftentimes significant wealth can compromise a marriage. And I think a lot of people might be surprised by that because they would think that if you don't have money worries, what do you have to fight about? Tell us why it is that you have found in your experience that significant wealth can really compromise those relationships.
Well, there's two sides of that, Michelle. The first part of that is people that become wealthy with their wives. And then there's those people that have been divorced and are now trying to find new wives that have wealth. The first one is just the issue of when a lot of money comes to play, husband and or wife, whoever made the money, has their time taken more and more and more. It reminds me of the time when I saw the CEO of a very large Fortune 500 company sitting on the beach with his kids playing in Hawaii, and he did nothing but tend to two iPads, two phones, and a laptop that he had the entire time he was sitting on the beach. That's all he did. And so there's this sense that we're growing apart. We don't have the same direction anymore, and frankly, we have the money to be able to afford to divorce each other. The second side of that is the husband or wife who's divorced now, so now you've got a single person going out to the marketplace and looking for love. And the people that are usually interested in them become very interested in them, and it doesn't seem like it's because of their money. But somewhere in the process, oftentimes, and I would say most times, they knew of that person because they had money, and they headed in that direction to make sure that if that particular person that's interested in being married, I'm talking about the non-wealthy person, the have-not, is closing in on someone, they want to make sure that if they married for love the first time, they want to make sure that they have lots of money the second time.
Hmm. You also talk about kids, you know, how children can be affected by wealth. And some of the stories you talk about, the sense of entitlement, are really sickening. You know, just and things that you might expect, you know, kids just going off and just buying, you know, whatever, and parents just setting no boundaries at all because it doesn't affect their financial bottom line. But one of the, I think, the most powerful stories in the book is your own, where you talked about how one of your sons racked up thousands of dollars in credit card debt without your knowledge and thought you would bail him out, and you didn't. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, that was my son, Todd. He was at University of Southern California. We put him on a budget, and the lifestyle that he was wanted to engage there with a lot of the kids that were there was more than he could afford. And so without telling us, he basically started taking every credit card that was offered to him, and by the time he graduated, he had $48,000 in debt, in addition to you know, the things that he had obligations for with regard to his school. And it was horrific, and it created a situation where my wife and I sat looking at each other, and my wife said, he's a great kid, he got great grades, he's going on to graduate school, pay it off. Just write a check and pay it off. And I said, first of all, I can't do that, and second of all, I won't do that. And we made him pay, and over the next years, he lived with four guys in an apartment. He had very little he could do for 4 years. He went on to school, a graduate school, and now he's got a job, and he has paid that off. And at the very end, he wrote a check. I told him if he ever got a bonus, he would have to use the entire bonus to pay the balance off, which he did. And he and I were both in tears when we watched, after 4 years, that balance go to zero. He said, I never felt so good to be poor, Dad.
I'm speaking with Richard Watts. He's the author of the new book, Fables of Fortune, What Rich People Have That You Don't Want. It chronicles some of the difficulties that extreme wealth can actually cause with or bring to people and their families. So what about people who are struggling to pay their mortgage, people that are probably listening to our conversation and are struggling to pay their mortgages or struggling to keep the kids' college funds funded so that they kids can have some choices, you know, later on, or struggling to make sure that they have something to live on in retirement? You know, what's your message for them?
Well, you know, there are varying different levels of where people are. And certainly people that aren't eating and don't have a roof over their head, I feel awful for them and feel that they are entitled to gain whatever they can from life to put themselves out of that position. What I'm really aiming at is the middle, the people that are making, you know, 75,000, I think Time Magazine said, and above, the people that really have the opportunity to live on what they have. And my message to them is it's probably best for you to quit dreaming about something you will probably never have, but to really recognize the blessings of where you're at and what you've got, and just to enjoy the things that you've got, because there's things you've got that the wealthiest families in America can't get.
Finally, have you ever met anybody or worked with anybody who can have their cake and eat it too? Can you be wealthy and not wind up with all these problems that you talk about in the book, bratty kids, you know, entitled spouses that you're not really sure what their motives are? I just want to be ready in case Powerball comes through.
I speak about that in the book on several occasions, that there are people that do this, but the very interesting thing is that what they do with the money is they begin to use it as a security blanket, and they don't use it in order to elevate their lifestyle. So the ones that have been successful at it have done it basically to create security. And the Warren Buffetts of the world, when they get to a place where they can have anything, they don't allow themselves to have anything, and they make sure that they continue to echo to themselves that this was never about having jets and 15 homes and having more than I could possibly own in the way of a wardrobe and house in one place. It's really about the journey, and it's about security. And so they put themselves in a position where they want something in the future instead of putting themselves in a position where anything they dream, they go get.
Richard Watts is the author of the new book, Fables of Fortune, What Rich People Have That You Don't Want. He joined us from Costa Mesa, California. Mr. Watts, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Michelle, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Anyone who watches NASCAR knows the cars out on the track are plastered with ads. Golfers almost all wear their sponsorships, but not U.S. Olympians. NPR's Mike Pesca reports that some runners are now chafing at longstanding rules blocking them from raising sponsorship money.
The steeplechase is 7.5 times around the track, leaping over 28 hurdles and 7 water barriers along the way. Start typing steeplechase into YouTube, and autocomplete quickly suggests steeplechase fail. Indeed, videos of athletes going headfirst into the drink may well be this sport's best shot at widespread notoriety. Or maybe it's Anthony Famoletti. Fam, as most call him, is a 2-time Olympian who goes headfirst into everything in life other than the water. But in a sport like steeplechase, the only kind of sponsorship a runner can realistically hope for comes from shoe companies. And Anthony Famoletti had a problem. A big one, in fact.
I haven't told anybody this, but I have arthritis in my foot, and it hurts every single day. When I race the steeplechase, it's bone on bone in my foot. And so why do I still go out there when it's so painful? One of my new slogans for the company is sustain the pain, where you're putting yourself out there to overcome these things that you struggle with in life.
The arthritis caused Famoletti to jettison his usual equipment.
The shoes didn't fit. If the shoes don't fit, there's really nothing you can do. There's only one shoe that I can wear of the thousands of shoes on the market, and trust me, I've tried everything. Zappos probably hates me.
Zappos wasn't the problem. His sponsor was. Can't wear the shoes, can't take the money. So Fam came up with another source of funding. Through his site Reckless Running, Famoletti solicited donations and rewarded a randomly selected donor by displaying the donor's son's name on a racing shirt. An idea was born. Fam is now selling sponsorship spots on his shirt. Rules prohibit him from wearing the singlet in Olympic qualifying competition or the games themselves, but in all the races leading up to those events, he'll proudly display your name, cause, Twitter feed, or weekly special on apricots. This idea, breaking free of the tight sponsorship guidelines of the U.S. Track and Field Federation, isn't unique to Famoletti. Nick Simmons, America's top man in the 800 meters, auctioned off ad space on his shoulder in the form of a temporary tattoo.
The manufacturers of the clothing, if they don't want to have logos distracting from their beautiful outfits, I understand that. However, for someone to tell me what I can and can't put on my body is absurd.
A Milwaukee-based marketing company bought the space for a little over $11,000. Simmons says his primary sponsor, Nike, who he appreciates as a sponsor he wants known, has not formally commented on the tattoo, which he has to cover with duct tape before nationals or during the Olympics. Simmons will use the money for such necessities as groceries and transportation, which many of his competitors in the Olympics have supplied for them by their national federations. Like Famoletti, who's 33, Simmons is a relative veteran at age 28, and he allows that it might be hard for less experienced athletes to see beyond the next day's training session.
I don't necessarily think that it's the athlete's job to rally behind me and, you know, spit in the face of the governing bodies. Absolutely not. Athletes, their first priority needs to be to run well. I just happen to get a kick out of all this.
Simmons and Famoletti are the rare athletes who don't mind rattling the cages of the international sportocracy. Like all elite athletes, their training and preparation reflects a monastic devotion to their sport. But for them, vows of poverty and silence need not be part of the package. Mike Pesca, NPR News.